so we're going to talk about your article, which has been published in Science today, which is February 19th, 2016. But if we can just set the scene a bit first, talking about the last financial crisis, why didn't people see it coming? And why hasn't traditional economic theory since been able to really explain what happened?
Yeah, so I think, first of all, crises are complicated things, and these things can be difficult to anticipate. If they were easy to anticipate, people could make lots of money by anticipating them. But that said, when you look at the models that were being used by central banks in the time leading up to the crisis, the models didn't have the key elements in them that were needed to model what went wrong with the economy. They didn't have banks in them. They didn't have the concept of default built into them. So the things that were central to the crisis weren't there. They didn't have housing markets. So if you're not even trying to model those things, you're not going to be able to model them. In a slightly snotty article in 2009, Duncan Foley and I said the models weren't even good enough to be wrong, and meaning what I just said. And so we strongly feel that we need to put those things in. Now, let me just say that economists are trying very hard, actually, and working very hard and making some progress in putting those things in. But the approach that's being taken is not an approach that I think will accomplish the goal.
In this piece in Science, what are you and your co-authors calling for?
We're calling for new approaches to modeling the economy that would be drawn from techniques from complex systems. Those approaches try and model the economy from the bottom up by taking the notion that we have heterogeneous agents seriously, without demanding that the world sit in an equilibrium.
Can I just ask you there what a heterogeneous agent actually
okay.
is?
That's a good question. Heterogeneous agents reflect the fact that I'm different than you. You're younger than I am. You might have a different economic status than I do. And that those details may really matter when we're modeling the world. Typical economics models, traditional economics models, have a representative agent. So there's one consumer that represents all consumers in the world. There's frontier models that try to tweak that a little bit, but we think you need to take that a lot farther. And that's just one example of the kind of things that we think need to be changed. Another key thing that we think needs to be changed is the notion of an equilibrium. So in an equilibrium in economics, you anticipate what I'm thinking about, and I take into account what you're thinking about, and we base our decisions on that collective understanding in a fairly deep way. And we furthermore assume that if we took those decisions, we would settle on a fixed point, meaning we would just make a decision and we wouldn't be changing those decisions as we go along unless new information arrives to make us change them. But in complex systems, we think actually that's not in general sufficient.
It seems insane that anybody could think it would be. Really.
Well, yeah, insane might be a strong word to use, but you have to look back at the history of economics. You have to always remember economics is an inherently hard problem, because in economics you have to take into account the fact that people think, and people can reason, and people can reason from first principles. And so that makes the problem difficult. And oddly enough, by assuming that everybody's rational, which is what was traditionally done in economics, you can make the problem easier, because the rational solution is typically an optimal and unique solution that you can calculate. Whereas as soon as we say we're human, the problem gets more complicated, because there's a lot of dimensions from being human. As Chris Sims, who won a Nobel Prize a couple of years ago, says, he worried about the danger of getting lost in the wilderness of bounded rationality. And so, yes, it's a hard problem, but on the other hand, it's an essential part of the problem that we think needs to be tackled.
So what work specifically have you been doing in this area, and what sort of insights have you been able to produce?
So we've been looking in particular at financial instability and what's called systemic risk. So systemic risk happens, well, let me actually first explain the opposite of systemic risk. The standard approach until the crisis was to think about things like banks in isolation. So you go to the bank and you ask, well, do you have a solid balance sheet? Do you have plenty of equity on the books? Do you have plenty of capital so that if something happens from the outside, what economists would call a shock? So if you have a shock, are you going to be able to deal with that shock? And that's, of course, a good thing to do and an important thing to think about. But what we've seen in the crisis, and we're by no means the first people to point this out, is that there can be systemic risk. That is, Bank A may act in order to manage its risk, and Bank B may act in order to manage its risk, and they all may do something in unison that causes a systemic problem because they're all acting together that, for example, may cause prices to go down a lot more than they otherwise would because they all end up selling at the same time. And so you really need to think about the dynamics of the interaction of the banks. And this is a good way to illustrate the complex systems approach. The center idea of complex systems is that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And in particular, the parts may be qualitatively different than the whole and give rise to phenomena that are qualitatively different, things we would call emergent phenomena.
So, is the whole more dangerous than the sum of its parts?
Well, the whole in this case, it can be more dangerous than the individual pieces. And even if all the banks on their own are quite sound from the shocks that you would normally think would hit them, they collectively might cause an internally generated shock that's bigger than any of the shocks that you would normally think would hit. And something like that went on in a crisis. And so we've been working at ways to try and understand that. In particular, we've been looking at the Basel II rules, which were the way that banks were recommended to manage their risk through the crisis. And we've shown that those rules in and of themselves may have been a substantial contributor to the crisis. In fact, we show that might have caused the whole thing. In particular, we just finished a paper where we assume that banks follow the Basel II rules. They do what empirically we know banks actually do, that is they look at the historical volatility of the markets and they use that to estimate their current volatility. And they then adjust their risk levels based on what Basel II would tell them to do. And we show that that can be sufficient to have caused a 10 to 15 year slow buildup in prices and leverage, where the banks take more and more risk, prices go up and up, volatility slowly goes down and down as markets get quieter and quieter, but because they're taking more and more leverage, the system gets more and more unstable, and finally something very dramatic happens where prices and leverage fall precipitously and volatility spikes up, and then the cycle repeats itself in some chaotic way, so it's not quite the same from cycle to cycle. So in other words, in a very simple model, we can reproduce some behavior that looks a lot like the crisis. And it suggests that the housing markets might have just been the spark that lit the fire, and that this behavior may have been maybe intrinsic to Basel II, combined with the banks taking a bit too much risk. And it's a systemic effect that nobody understood because it wasn't obvious to any of the individuals, but when you understand the collective interactions, it emerges.
Wow, because I think, as you know, as far as I know, and I guess a lot of other people must think the same, you're of the impression that it was all down to the housing market. So perhaps that's another whole podcast there with that one.
Yeah, I mean, the housing market was an important contributor, and it showed examples of this same kind of thing. And actually, we are working with the Bank of England on a model of housing markets that actually reflects work we've been doing for some time, an agent-based model of housing markets in which We model the behavior of individual households and their savings and consumption, and in particular borrowing behavior here, and how bank policy affects the housing market as a whole. So I'm not saying the housing markets weren't important, but I am saying that in both cases you get these collective phenomena. In our housing model, we also see booms and busts in the housing markets arising spontaneously just by virtue of the bank letting people borrow too much. As we turn up the borrowing, we see the system becomes more unstable and we see more oscillatory behavior.
So I guess that's just, you know, another factor in the whole complex system.
That's right.
One of your colleagues on this, who's co-authored this this piece, what he seems to be saying is that, you know, it seems to be a real disconnect between economic theory and real world human behavior, which I guess is something that we've covered talking about these agents. Is that the case? And if so, you know, why has it taken so long to kind of tackle this disconnect?
Yeah, I mean, economics has been wrestling with this problem for a long time. And a whole new field has emerged called behavioral economics, trying to really take psychology seriously and incorporate that into economic theory. It was very slow in coming. It's surprising that it had such a hard time breaking into the mainstream. It has broken in, but I would say when you look at what's done, the way in which the models are built still very much reflects the notion of rational expectations. Equilibrium is still very much a part of the story. And I think the traditional economists haven't quite figured out how to really properly incorporate behavioral economics into the story. We think the complex systems approaches we're talking about, and agent-based modeling in particular, are the right way to do that.
So let's talk about agent-based models. Can you tell me a bit about them? How do they work?
So the concept of an agent-based, in a sense, all economics models are agent-based models. But when we say that, we mean models that are explicitly computational in a deep sense, where we try and model individual households, and we try and model the savings and consumption and other behaviors of those households. And we do that in some detail. And so, for example, in our agent-based model of British housing markets, we can't model all 20 million households in Britain, but we have 5,000 to 10,000 households that differ in terms of their age and their income, and we keep track of all of them, and they make different decisions depending on what happens. And it's, in a sense, a kind of virtual reality simulation of the UK, scaled down because we don't have the computational capacity to deal with all 20 million households, and in which we try and make things as realistic as we possibly can. So we set up those households so they mimic the age and income distribution of the UK.
And is anyone else doing this? You know, governments, banks?
Well, there are various researchers are making agent-based modeling right now. And the Bank of England is on the forefront and having several different projects now involving agent-based modeling. We're working closely with them in one, which involves the housing markets.
And is the appetite there from governments, banks, big corporations to incorporate this kind of modeling?
It's certainly there for corporations. Many companies like Southwest Airlines, for example, has an agent-based model of their business. And this technique is becoming increasingly popular with businesses. As I already mentioned, the Bank of England is on the vanguard of using agent-based models for understanding the economy. They're really on the vanguard, I have to say. Not that many banks are doing it, but there is interest on the part of banks. The central banks feel like something went wrong in the crisis. They got blindsided and they didn't have tools that were useful to them. And so their ears are open for alternatives, though that said, it's hard to actually bring the alternatives there. Because from their point of view, you really have to reduce things to practice. Academic economics is not, let's say this is on the fringe. particularly in America, which occupies a central role in the economics profession. I do have European colleagues, they're my co-authors on this paper, and there are some others that aren't co-authors in this paper. And so certainly there's a community and the community's active, but it's not nearly as large as mainstream economics and is still not very broadly accepted.
And do you think that's going to change? How long would it take to...
Well, our paper is in a sense saying it's time for it to change. Now, how long it actually takes to change, we'll have to see. I'm hoping this will happen in my lifetime, and I'm 63. So I'm hoping it will change in the next 10 to 20 years.
Can you tell me a bit about your co-authors on this article? What sort of disciplines are they coming from?
So my co-authors are a mixture mainly of economists and physicists. Actually, one of them, I think, may be trained in sociology, and a couple of them are biologists, Bob May and Martin Sheffers, working in biology now. So it's a diverse group.
And part of what you're saying is that you need all these different disciplines to feed into tackling this problem.
Yeah, we think it's important to bring in different points of view and take advantage of the collective expertise of people from different disciplines.
Last question. Is a complex system of this size just too big to ever really be safe to be able to control?
I think not. Of course, you're never going to fully control something like this. I think a proper analogy for what might be called complex systems engineering is gardening. You know, you have some control over your garden, but ultimately stuff happens. It's not like building a watch. So there's always going to be that element to complex systems. You try and set things up so the rules are what you want. When it deviates from what you want, you fiddle with those rules, or you may explicitly apply corrections like the central bank does when they change interest rates. But you're never going to have full control. On the other hand, I think you do have some control. We are free to pick the rules. The rules that we had through the crisis were not the right set of rules. We were letting people take much too much risk, and that bit us. And had we better understood what was going on, we could have prevented that from happening. So I think it is imperative to get a better understanding of what's going on. And with that better understanding, we really can make the world a better place. And even if we can't prevent crises, we can make them less frequent, we can make them less severe, and we can really change the future.